When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Grand Canyon University, an affordable private Christian university, is one of the largest and fastest growing universities in the country, offering more than 270 programs online. In addition to federal grants and aid, GCU's online students received nearly $130 million in institutional scholarships in 2022. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu/myoffer to see the scholarships you may qualify for.
The ultimate episode of Goosebumps is over, but we're just getting started here on post-show recaps. I'm your host, Melissa, here with the horror aficionado himself, Todd. Todd, we don't get to say penultimate in life nearly as often as we do in podcasting. I like use that phrase to refer to television shows more often than any other aspect of my life. You don't often know if things are the penultimate thing, I guess.
Very true, very true. But it's a good word to use. I'm happy that we do get the option to use it, because agreed, unless you're talking about some sort of TV series or book series or things like that, it just doesn't come up enough in everyday life.
Yeah, you really don't want to be talking about like the penultimate lunch you ate, right?
Like, yeah. That,
don't know. I'm trying to think of like other possible if you've used the word penultimate in just like casual conversation, not referring to media, let me know. I'm intrigued. Anyway, let's talk about the episode.
Yes, let's talk about the episode. I just want to say straight off, like, your guess about it being Nathan was correct. You guessed that.
Yeah.
Nathan was the one. Yeah. So, so all of my guesses were not. I don't know if either one of us would have guessed that's how he wound up being the one to get slappy, but you definitely were right on the money about who it was.
Yeah, it's funny. I liked your guesses better. I think there's an aspect of it that would have been really interesting if that had been the way they went. But yeah, I think it was just the editing of the like next time on that we saw, where it was like a scene with Nathan, and then like the immediate next scene I think was the slappy being like, oh, he, so I think that just like juxtaposed it in my mind. And yeah, I definitely, the like wink and a nod of him like writing the Goosebumps book, I guess, is pretty strange but kind of appropriate. Yeah, I don't know. We'll get into it, but it was definitely one of those where I was like, gosh, this guy just truly sucks, and I'm glad that we've sort of been hating on the comedy of it this entire time.
Yeah, I kind of hate how they've done the character a little bit, because I remember really liking him in the first episode.
Yeah.
Like, the first episode, I liked him a lot. And yeah, he was the one that set this all in motion by, like, cutting his hand because he was stubborn with the crowbar or whatever. But that whole scene between him and Isaiah at the end of the first episode, or towards the end of the first episode, where he's like, yeah, you're a teenager, you're wired to do stupid things. He's just like a really, he's like a really cool, understanding teacher. And that is, that Nathan that we got in that scene has not been represented in any other scene we've seen of Nathan in the series since then. So yeah, I was like, been chalking a lot of it up to, oh, that's just like, you know, Harold in his body, but you know, maybe some of Nathan bled into Harold, because yeah, like you said, he's not great. He's not great at all. And I kind of hate it that he's that not great, but that's where we are. So I guess that's what we, that's who he is.
Yeah, it's a little bit cartoony in his, like, doofusness that I didn't really expect from this show. And it's funny. I know you've watched Gilmore Girls as well, right? But there's this, like, concept of the fact that you, like, in order to make room for a new character that the writers want you to like, they'll, like, make the old character worse, right? So the Dean of it all, that, like, Dean started out not bad. And then he was, like, turned into like a pretty big jerk, and so that we all liked Jess more, right? And it, like, we're okay with that transition being made and then done again, I think, to like make Logan somehow supposed to be appealing, although they still failed at that task. This is not a Gilmore Girls podcast, but it was almost like they did that, but in like the same season of television, which is wild, where it's like, yeah, we want you now to like not like this guy that you were maybe set up to find to be a sympathetic character now. And we're just going to like absolutely throw him under the bus for no reason in order to like set up this plot in a way that doesn't totally make sense to me.
Yeah. I've been enjoying the show, but this episode, definitely not my favorite. I think there are a couple of things I liked in it, but a lot of the plot beats just did not work for me at all, and most of the Nathan stuff really didn't work for me. And again, it's just, I had such high hopes for the character after the first episode. You know, I raved about, like, I can't wait to see more of this, you know, character. And now I'm like, yeah, we could have just stopped at episode one with the character, and I would have been much happier probably, because this is a big character assassination episode for Nathan, for sure. But let's get into it and talk about why it doesn't quite work for us. So this episode is called Night of the Living Dummy 2. Involves very little of the living dummy for being Night of the Living Dummy 2, but okay. but it starts off in a flashback to 6 months ago in Portland, where Nathan was lecturing a class about the importance of imagination and being great writers, which is odd since it turns out to be a biology class. Later at home, Nathan gets a call from the principal firing him because apparently it wasn't the first time that he's done something like this. Just as his landlord shows up asking for rent, and his poodle Fifi runs into traffic and gets run over. So just not a great day for Nathan there. Then we see 3 days later, while lighting a candle at his shrine to his best friend, the fallen Fifi, a lawyer arrives to tell him about his inheritance. A quick montage of the events of the past 8 episodes later, and Nathan stumbles into his house, collapses, and realizes that he now has fodder to write a book.
Yeah, okay. Okay. like, I don't, it's so, again, like, cartoonishly weird all of a sudden. Like, this man has no concept of how to teach or what even classes he's supposed to be teaching. He's so, I don't even understand what we're supposed to think is happening to him. Like, is he just that buffoonish? Is he that stupid? Like, what is, there's no like plausibility to what's happening here that I'm just like, you know, again, I get it. Like, also, I knew that dog was going to die the moment that we saw. Oh. I was like, that dog is not surviving this episode. Yeah, I what is, I don't know. I, yeah. Anyway, the very first note I have of this episode is, oh no, something's going to happen to that dog.
So. R.I.P. Fifi. Yeah, it just is, like I said, it's so cartoonish. It's so broad. It is, they could have done a way to show him getting fired for other types of incompetence that would have made more sense, you know?
Yeah.
Or he could have just been, we didn't even need him to be fired, honestly. We just need to have him like struggling with money problems because let's face it, teachers don't get paid well. So you don't necessarily need to have him be fired to be having money problems as someone who is the son of an English teacher. I'm well aware of the struggles of educators to make a living wage. So they could have just focused on that and had him like maybe not connecting with his students, maybe doing mm-hmm. something stupid, but to have him go on this very impassioned speech about how to be a great writer when he's supposed to be subbing for a biology class is just dumb. It just makes absolutely no sense. There is no reason for it. It's not even like he was like trying to do an analogy of comparing writing to biology in some way that got away from him that we saw. It's just straight up just talking about the power of imagination. And it's just like, it made absolutely no sense. And I hated it. The other stuff like him, and also like the principal just firing him over the phone after he like did this. It was not necessarily a fireable offense. I mean, I don't know how long he'd be teaching there. I guess he didn't have tenure yet, but it seems like very odd. It just, the whole setup there is strange and I don't like it.
Yeah, I don't know if we're supposed to. My guess is that it was just played to be a joke of like, oh, this guy is like trying to teach writing in a biology class or whatever. Like, I think that it was just supposed to be written as like this throwaway line that was supposed to be a joke. But to me, it was just like, what is happening here? And then, like, I agree with you that either him like not connecting with his students, or not being that good at what he's doing. Like, I think it would have been sort of interesting to play this part that, like, he maybe isn't that good at this. Like, he isn't that talented or creative. And so some stuff were like, I don't even have a great idea of how you do it, but if he's teaching this class and sort of like getting shown up by his students, like not actually, maybe he's like stuck at that like high school writing level of every, you know, that Harold was at, right? Where everything is like really angsty and like not that deep, but trying to be deep. Like, I could see that being maybe an interesting beat of like, yeah, there's a reason he's never been published up until now, because his writing just like isn't that creative and isn't that engaging. And then it turns out you hand him this story that is like, okay, now he's finally finding success. Like, I think there was a way for this first scene to build on the story we were telling in this episode that it just didn't, that didn't make any sense. And I agree, he like doesn't have to be fired, but again, like, I guess we're just supposed to see that like the world is beating him down so much that that's why he's so desperate for like Slappy to come and help him. But again, like everything that we saw happen to him was his own poor decision making, so it's like he's not sympathetic in any way. I don't know if he's supposed to be. And then like, yeah, I guess it made me so turned off by the whole thing from jump that I was just like, I was annoyed by the rest of this happening rather than something where I'm like, oh man, like what's going to happen? This is a guy that, you know, we now like feel sorry for. And that's kind of interesting to see him being kind of like Slappy kind of manipulating him in some way. I don't know. There was just no like subtlety to any of it happening. It felt very, very like, look at this idiot over here who like can't even tell what class he's in. Can't pay his rent, now suddenly got another teaching job, I guess, because he, I don't know how he got hired at the other school, but I guess he did. And then like we got no hint of this otherwise. I'd like Doesn't Lucas think he's a good teacher? We got that line earlier. So I was like, I don't know about that, but I guess he at least is teaching English in Port Lawrence. So maybe he is a good English teacher and just not a good biology teacher. I don't know. It's stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. But I agree that they could have done better to tie this opening scene up to like him as a writer and why he hasn't been successful. Because I feel like the show has been successful at that with all the kids episodes of tying the themes of their inner struggles with the everything else. And it just, this feels just so off. This opening scene, everything about it just feels off. And I don't know what they were thinking. But I think we have murdered this scene enough and we can like move on to murder the rest of the episode. Cause I feel like we'll have a few other things to complain about. So we next cut to a montage of how everyone is doing post Slappy, accompanied by a voiceover from Nathan reading from the end of his novel with thinly veiled aliases and cosmetic tweaks to events. So we have Ken training Isaac in the snow. Of course, that's Ben and Isaiah. And then Jesse and Lizabetta for James and Isabella hanging out at the library. Madison and Linus having a budding nerdy romance that's about to be tested by her mother, Sorrel. Sorrel for Sarah. It's just an interesting move there.
Yeah.
But basically, Sarah wants her daughter to move back to Seattle with her. And then Maura confesses to Coulter about her role in the death of Horace Boodle. And then he proposes. And finally, Nathan finishes his novel about the evil dummy Snappy and his own alter ego, the dashing heroic Nicholas Back. So, good grief. Good grief, Nathan.
Yeah, again, like, is this supposed to be funny? Like, we've talked before about, like, who is this show for? And I was fairly convinced that it was kind of a pretty broad category that like you and I were enjoying watching this show. You know, we know members of the Discord who've talked about watching this show with their kids who've enjoyed it. And then suddenly it feels like the level of humor here is just there's zero subtlety to it. And it's also like, I don't, again, like why are we saying, again, like I totally get that he's telling the story of the thing and it's super thinly veiled. Okay. I guess it was just, there was so much to this that I was like, we get it. It's the exact same, like move on. I'm already tired of this joke because it's just not funny. It's okay. I get it. He's writing the story into a book. It's basically the same thing. Move next. Like,
On one hand, I kind of appreciate it as a way of like doing the montage and getting us caught up on how everyone's been doing in the week since the Slappy events. I think that in theory, it could have worked, but it didn't. And I don't know. I think it was the level of writing that he was doing. And it bothers me even more in retrospect, considering how like much praise his writing was given. But like if I was doing a novel and it wrapped everything up in like a 2-paragraph thing of, and here's what all our characters are doing now, I wouldn't think that's a very good ending to a novel either. So
yeah,
I don't know. But to talk a little bit about the actual events that are happening here instead of like critiquing Nathan's writing. So we see Isaiah training in the snow with his dad, and his dad is all excited because Isaiah is getting back up to like snuff a little bit, but you get a little brief snippet of Isaiah kind of looking wistful. Like, oh man, I kind of wish I wasn't doing this. Like, he's doesn't seem to be too excited about going back to being the star athlete again. And then the James and Isabella is mainly just like James has, you know, gotten the guy to say yes to a date, and Isabella looks a little wistful about her own romantic prospects. And then, of course, we have our couple dating. Because Margot and Lucas at the library, and this is one of the more interesting things, because Margot and Lucas is like a huge part of this episode. And the thing that gets pointed out is that she's giving him books to read. And oh, I think you'll like this. So he has a huge stack of books to read. And the voiceover is like, oh yeah, it's a nerdy romance that's blooming. But it very much seems like Margot, like Lucas wanting to impress Margot, and Margot trying to, like, you know, give him stuff that she thinks, you know, that she likes. And I feel like this is just like the first little hint of, yeah, I don't know if they're as compatible as they think they are. Just, it felt very strange for Lucas to be the one getting all these books, because nothing that we've seen so far has shown that Lucas is someone who is, like, suddenly ready to become, like, knowledgeable or well-read or anything like that. It instantly read to me like, yeah, he's trying to please Margot. And
yeah.
And I think we'll see that play out over the course of the episode, like the how they're not really jiving like that. And then, of course, I mentioned, like, Sarah is wanting Margot to move to Seattle with her, and Nora is confessing to Colin about everything that happened with the Herald, and then he proposes and she accepts, which it was a very sweet, very cute moment between them. That was something in the scene that I thought really did work well, that where the comedy did work well of him, like, saying he wanted to, like, do it out with her camping and have, like, tied to a bear or something. And then she's like, I would have preferred the bear thing. You know? So I thought that was really, really cute.
Yeah, that was cute. Although I do have to note that tying a ring to a bear is a terrible proposal. That would,
yeah, like, no.
Don't touch bears. and any proper Pacific Northwesterner would know that. But yeah, I did appreciate the joke, and I thought it was cute. The Margot and Lucas relationship thing, it's absolutely, like, a big topic of this episode. I don't particularly care about it, which didn't help this episode, but I don't think it's unrealistic for two kids at this age to have been, like, brought together through these, like, kind of stressful circumstances. They've started dating and then realizing that they don't actually have that much in common, but one of them is, you know, they're like, one of them is all about, like, hey, being in a relationship means that we like the same thing, so here's all the books I like, because I think that that is a very, like, teenage view of how relationships work. Yeah. And then I think the other one being like, oh, I have to impress the smart girl, so I'm going to pretend like I'm reading all these books that she's giving me. Like, I didn't think any of that, at least, was unrealistic. I just don't care about teenage romance in this show. Because I also don't know how we're supposed to, like, are we supposed to be rooting for Margot and Lucas? I have no idea what the show's point of view is on that.
Yeah, I'm a little confused about who the show wants us to root for as well. Because is it Margot and Lucas? Is it Margot and Isaiah? Is it Isaiah and Isabella? I just don't know. I don't know if the show even cares. If the show's just, like, throwing all these things out there to see whose chemistry works and that's who they'll wind up with. I don't know, but I am admittedly not a big romance follower on things. I don't usually have, like, people I'm heavily shipping most of the time. It's more like, okay, I just don't want them together because they annoy the heck out of me as a couple. So I want them to fail because I don't like them as a couple. But I very rarely am like, oh, yes, they have to get together. Yeah, I don't have that much of romance in me. So that aspect of these shows is just something that I'm like, okay, yeah, we can move past this. So maybe not the best person to speak to that. But I agree. I've never really bought the Margot Lucas relationship, I guess. It just came out of nowhere. Not as out of nowhere as Isabel's crush on Isaiah did, but it just felt very fast-tracked. And like you said, it's like, yeah, these kids have been thrown into these, like, dangerous situations, so that makes sense. But for Margot and Lucas to go from, like, barely even interacting, even though he seemed to have a crush on her, she didn't really care about him. I don't know. I think everything with the kids in this whole opening montage feels truthful to the characters that we've seen before, and I think that it's well done. I think if we hadn't had the narration done the way it was done, it probably would have landed a lot better, but I think it did do a good job of setting up what the new status quo is right now. We then get a scene of Nathan talking about the trauma that he went through to Ben as Ben mounts the stuffed Fifi amongst the deer heads at the Biddle house, which is a pretty funny image of all this row of deer heads and this stuffed poodle being just stuck at the end of them. Nathan mentions his
also, I have to note here, sorry, this past scene, he writes the ending, closes it, and sends it. And I was like, this man has made zero edits to this story and has no idea how to write a book. It was just like the most ridiculous thing that they couldn't even pretend like he was reviewing it for like the final edit or the final draft. Right? He was like literally typing it out. And I was like, I don't know why that drove me so nuts. I was like, you have to do like a single round of edits at minimum.
Look, when you're a once-in-a-generation talent, like Nathan, you don't need
the next Stephen King, if you will. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, oh yeah, we'll talk about that.
Something tells me Stephen King edits his books before he publishes them.
Yeah, I have many things to say about that conversation later, but again, we'll get to it. But Nathan mentions this wonderful book to Ben, which he describes as Stephen King's Carrie meets Stephen King's The Shining, but with a bit of levity. He then also asks if he can pay Ben later because he's low on cash. And I mean, props to Nathan for at least mentioning to Ben that he's written a book based on Ben's childhood crimes that resulted in the death of somebody. But still, I think that's the one thing, like Nathan, it's, you're writing about this thing that is so thinly veiled that if anyone looks into it at all, they could go, oh, this fire of this kid could have been caused by these other kids. Again, Nathan not thinking things through, and Ben is understandably not looking too happy about this. But I think the one important thing to note in this scene is like Nathan is talking to Ben about his trauma because he doesn't have anyone else to talk to it about it. But he's like, that's what friends are for, right? And Nathan refers to Ben as a friend multiple times in the scene, and Ben is just kind of awkwardly there like, yeah, friends. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a very one-sided thing. It's Nathan, lonely Nathan, who a few episodes ago had said, he's going through a bit of transition in his life, lost his best friend Fifi, and now he is like a lonely, lonely man who's gone through some pretty traumatic stuff, and he's looking for someone to, help him work through it, and not really finding them.
Yeah. My main question for this man, if you have inherited a home and theoretically your housing costs have now been cut down drastically, still paying property taxes, upkeep, homeownership is expensive, but relatively much, much less. Where's all your money going, bud? Don't you have a teaching job? I get that teachers don't make a lot of money. They do make some money. So I was like, where's your money going if you have no money right now? Like, maybe he hasn't been teaching for the last, has he taken like a leave of absence for the last few weeks while all the events are going down? I don't know, but like theoretically he's been teaching. I don't know. Maybe he hasn't been during the time he's been possessed, but
yeah. And it's also possible that he was in such horrible debt from before that all of his paychecks are going to pay off his debt. That was kind of my headcanon for it. But also it's interesting because I felt like the estate would have come with more than just the house from the way that the lawyer talked about it. Cause it wasn't just like, you've got the house. It's like your whatever's estate. But it might not have been any like financial stuff involved with it, but yeah, it's a little odd for him to be cash poor suddenly and asking Ben to put it off. But I could kind of headcanon my way around it. Just like he was obviously in horrible debt because he was not paying his rent at his old place. So even if he doesn't have any rent now, there's no telling how much credit card debt he was in, how much other stuff he was in. Yeah, it's a bit odd. Well, we next go to Lucas at home. He's reluctant to go on a road trip and leave his mom, but she tells him that he should not live his life in fear like she had for so many years. So he agrees to go. As he and the gang are getting ready to leave, they see Nathan, who tries to invite himself along on their trip until he gets a call from a publisher who is interested in the book, but who wants a new ending that explores Snappy's backstory. And this feels like such an odd juxtaposition with the couple episodes ago where he is very much, okay, so you're all calling me Nathan, but we need to get the boundaries because I am your teacher. Call me Mr. Brat. To suddenly, oh, hey, you're going on a trip. Let me come along with you. Again, he's depressionally lonely, dealing with stuff. But even so, we've seen examples of him trying to keep these boundaries in the past. And at this point, this man seems to have no idea that boundaries exist. It just feels so out of place.
Yeah, from like what, 2 episodes ago? Like, our memories aren't that short. I don't understand. It almost feels like the writer of this episode did not watch previous episodes. And it's just like, he sort of got a synopsis and is running with it. Because we're like, you're right. He literally just was like, let's, you know, back in the classroom, we're going to have to have whatever. And yeah, this was just like so cringy to the point of uncomfortable, where I was like, no, you are a grown up. You have to not do this. This is bad. And I get it. He's lonely. He's been through a big thing. He had been through most of that when we had this conversation with the kids in the house. So it like doesn't make any sense to me that he is suddenly so different. And at the end of the day, like, I don't care what you've been through, still not okay. Like, go talk to other random grownups the way at least you were trying to talk to Ben. Fine, leave children alone. This is not do not be a creepy man trying to hang out with high schoolers. Not okay in any situation.
Yeah, it just that whole sequence just like really, again, this is like feels like a character assassination episode for Nathan, completely obliterating any goodwill that we may have had for him in the past. And I don't understand it. I don't understand why they had to do this. I also don't understand how a publisher would call and be interested in this book. I mean, I guess we enjoyed most of the story up to this point. So I guess the fact that the book was fun, but the publisher is super interested, but then also like, oh, also super interested, but you need to write a new ending before we will even consider your book, which feels a little, I mean, I'm not a published author. I'm not really in the publishing industry, but that feels a little odd to me. And also like just a really specific, yeah, you need to rewrite the ending and hopefully something that gives us more about Snappy's backstory. And
yeah,
the only way most of what this publisher says or does in this episode makes any sense to me is if this publisher is actually evil and working for Slappy. It's like half the things that she says and does, like the only reason it makes any sense at all is if, you know, she's working for Slappy, because it makes no sense that not only are they, okay, you have to write a completely new ending for us to even like consider signing you. And it has to be this very specific thing that's going to lead you back to the evil dummy. It's a little convenient, kind of ham-handed, kind of on the nose. Yeah, it's, and I don't always have problems with that. There's a lot of this stuff that does have like the convenient plot points to drive the plot forward, but it's one of those things that if it was just this in a vacuum, I would just go, okay, whatever. But there's just so many things in this episode that don't work for me. It's just like one more discordant note amongst like a chorus of discordant notes. So it just like really feels forced.
There's also like zero reason why like Nathan could be the one to come up with the idea of it being like more about Slappy. Like, I don't know, it coming from her felt so ridiculous at this point that it was like, at least he could be the one to be like, you know, have him have that moment of like the end. Or was it? And then he's like fixated on this idea of like, what if it wasn't the end? What if there's more to this? Whatever, fine. Because it's not even like we got Slappy backstory in this, like, in this episode, right? So even if we get it next episode, it's just like, you can do this whole like, okay, what if Slappy's not gone yet? What if there's more to it? And that can happen without this like weird ham fisting, like you're saying, of her being like, it has to be about this. It has to be about his backstory, because that's the best time for backstory, is the climax of your, like the post climax of your story. Like, we're in the denouement phase very seriously right now. And I don't understand why this is when they're like, do you know what we need? More backstory. Like, what? In what universe is that good storytelling? I don't understand.
Yeah. Again, lots of issues with this.
I'm not even doing it in the show. Like, the show knows that's bad storytelling. They already gave us Slappy's backstory. It's done. Like, what?
Although I feel we're going to get more Slappy's backstory in the next episode, depending on how things end. So maybe the show doesn't know that's a bad thing. Yeah. We then see the gang pick up Margo for the road trip, and Colin gives some last-minute awkward fatherly advice. Just really brief scene. I don't know if there's a whole lot to talk about here, other than everything that Lucas says or does seems to make Isaiah cringe or roll his eyes. So I think there's still a little bit of that tension there. But is there anything in this thing that really jumped out at you?
Is this the one where they talk about, I have a note at some point in here. I can't remember when it comes up, just that Seattle is in fact known for its coffee shops. So that was like, whenever that got mentioned, I was like, that is true. There are a lot of coffee shops in Seattle. It's home of Starbucks.
Yeah. I can't remember if that was the scene or later, but very, very true statement.
Yeah. This is when I reveal to the listeners that my notes for this whole show have just been like stream of consciousness, random thoughts as I go with no context clues. So a lot of the time I'm like, what's this even mean? Why did I write about something? But you know, there's no time for context when you're trying to avoid looking at scary dummies. So
very true. Truer words have seldom been spoken. So next we see Nathan struggling to come up with a new ending. He finally gets inspired, but before he can share his they were dead all along twist with the publisher, she mocks a tired trope and he backpedals. And I will say her mocking that tired trope is the one thing that I agree with that comes out of her mouth in this episode. But she tells him that she needs a revised ending soon or they will have to move on, and that she thinks he could be the next Stephen King. Ego stroked, he assures her a Stephen King level ending is on its way. So,
can I say a thing before you go into this? Yes. Isn't Stephen King notoriously bad at endings?
Yes, yes, he is. And that was going to be part of my rant. Yes, that was going to be part of my rant.
Rant away.
So, my first rant here is, yeah, we think you're going to be the next Stephen King, but if you don't get this new ending to us shortly, we'll have to move on. Wait. You could be the next Stephen King. Stephen King, one of the highest selling authors of all time, extremely prolific, best selling author, so many films and TV shows and things off of his writing. You could be the next big thing, but if you don't give us this new chapter that we randomly decided you need to write within the next few days, we just can't even begin to consider signing you. It makes no sense. Again, the only reason this makes sense is if she's working for Slappy and is trying to push him to go find Slappy. That's the only reason that they would push the next Stephen King to do this. It hurt my brain, Melissa. It hurt my brain so much. It's just so manufactured. It's just, you know, makes no sense. And then, yes, Stephen King. I love Stephen King, first of all. Let me just start off with that. Stephen King is one of my favorite authors. I've read every novel he's written. I've read most of his short story collections, a couple I need to get caught up on. He's written some of my favorite books. He's also written some real stinkers. Not exactly, you know, it's not all high-quality work. Whenever you churn out as much as he does, there's, you know, bound to be a few clunkers here and there. But he is notorious for the fact that his endings are not always great. They're not uniformly bad. It's not universally bad, but there are quite a few of his novels that are great. And then you reach the last chapter and it's almost like he just goes, okay, I got to end it. Needless Things comes to mind. Needless Things. I love that novel, but the last chapter, the ending could not. I'm like, what are you doing? Even The Stand is a little bit like that as well. I love The Stand, but the ending is kind of like out of left field. There's plenty of his books that kind of fall in this realm of like 99% great, and then the ending just kind of like makes you go, and he's aware of this. They've joked about it. He was, I can't remember, there was maybe it was like It Chapter 2, I think, where he like had a cameo and made a joke about this, about a writer whose endings always suck. I think that was the one. But I know he came in a movie not too long ago where he basically made a joke about writers whose endings suck, you know, and basically it's like poking fun at himself. So that's a very well-known thing. But there is no irony at all in Nathan saying that he will write a Stephen King level ending. You already have a Stephen King level ending. That's why she's asking you to rewrite it. Yes. It's just, I don't know, as a horror fan, again, it's something that you, as a non-horror fan, are even aware of the fact that Stephen King is known for not having great endings. So it feels very bizarre for this show to say, have Nathan say this with no irony. And it could be, you know, if I wanted to give them grace, it could be like, okay, we're trying to show that Nathan doesn't know anything about this stuff after all. But the rest of the episode doesn't give me faith that that's what's going on.
Yeah, that's the thing, is I do, my guess is that this is in fact meant to be a joke, right? That it is in fact meant to be the fact that clearly neither of these two people have any idea what they're talking about, and that's what's going on here. But like, I do think that you can't assume that the audience will know that based on the clues. Like, it was, again, it was something that I was like, I'm pretty sure this is true, but again, I have read zero Stephen King books and watched zero Stephen King movies. So I don't actually know. I didn't actually know. I did need to check with you. And so it's like, you need to let the audience in on the joke if you're going to tell a joke. And maybe, again, it was like, okay, well, the horror fans will get it and everybody else won't, and that's fine. But I think you're right. The context of the episode at large doesn't give me a lot of faith that that was the kind of subtlety they were going for here, because literally nothing else about this episode has been subtle. So I don't know. It's so weird.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, like, I could see it being a good joke. It could be a really good joke if they had the other person react to it, if they didn't have anything else.
Yeah.
But in a vacuum, the way that's delivered is delivered with utter sincerity from him and is received with utter sincerity from the other end of the line. And if he said it and you had someone else there to like roll their eyes or something, or anything else to give like that context, it would have worked for me. But as it is, and because the rest of the episode has already beaten me down so much, on the one hand, yeah, I would fully assume that Nathan is someone who doesn't realize that that's a stupid thing to say. And I do realize that Nathan's someone that doesn't know that's a stupid thing to say, but I don't, this episode doesn't make me feel like it's intentional in the way that it should, I guess. It's, yeah. And also, but again, like they were dead all along twist. No, we don't need that. We don't need that. That is one of those twists that I have ranted about in the past. Back whenever I used to have a blog where I did like movie reviews, like many, many, many years ago. One time I went on this huge screed about the they were dead all along movie twists, because I'd seen so many in such a short span of time, and they're like 90% of them were done horribly. So it's not necessarily, it's like most tropes, it's not that the trope is bad. It's just that the trope is hard to pull off well, especially whenever everyone does it. And I have zero faith that Nathan could pull off this trope well. So,
that's the category for the movie recommendations at the end of the pod, right? people were dead all along, just like spoilers up front.
Oh my goodness. No. But I will give you a spoiler alert that we're about to have a commercial break. So have fun with those.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we're back. So we cut to Nora inviting the rest of the parents out to dinner and telling them that she would like to recapture the friendships they once had, that all the things that went through reminded her of the good times, and she'd like to recapture that. And Colin gets up from the table, is heading to the restroom, and runs into Nathan, who's picking up a to-go order. And Nathan says he's about to go on a drive to clear his head and move past his writer's block. And one thing I do want to mention here is, like, there is a running joke that every time Nathan runs into somebody, he's like, hey, it's really me. Ha ha. It's really me. Ha ha. Which I actually kind of appreciate as an awkward Nathan trying to like do the inside joke thing and failing horribly. That works for me a lot better than a lot of the other stuff does. But the thing that gets me here is I guess Nora told Colin about everything, not just about the herald of it all, but also the haunting and possessions and everything, and he believed her. Because earlier, like, the voiceover was like, yeah, and Nora told Colin about, you know, what happened with Harold when she was young. But this is like, oh yeah, no, they told him everything. And Colin, being the wonderful person he is, believes it. I guess whenever you have your you know, girlfriend and your ex-wife and your daughter and all of their friends, I think, all agreeing that this actually happened, I guess you have to believe. But still, he seems to be just like rolling with it pretty easily.
Do you know what? Colin believes women, and we simply love to see it.
Fair point.
I guess it is just one of those where, like, yeah, when that many people are all corroborating a story, you just have to be like, well, however improbable, I guess this is what happened.
Yeah. Well, we then cut over to Seattle, where the gang is at Margot's mom's house. Several of the members go out to get something from the corner shop, and Margot and Isaiah left alone. And Margot tells Isaiah that part of her is looking forward to a fresh start, but another part doesn't want to lose Lucas. And she asks him if he thinks Lucas seems off, and he deflects a bit, talking about how Seattle seems like her scene, but that ultimately she has to make the decision herself. And my one big question about this is, what kind of fresh start is she needing? What does she need a fresh start from, I guess, is my big question here. Because, I mean, all of her friends, she still has these friendships. She has a boyfriend. She has, like, a good relationship with her dad. I mean, she doesn't have a great relationship with her mom. So she's like, yeah, I kind of want to rekindle my relationship with my mom. That would make more sense to me. But the fresh start feels kind of odd to me, because we haven't necessarily seen that there's anything she needs to get a fresh start from, except everything she went through. Which, okay, but all of her friends and this group that she has bonded with and has come up to Seattle with her, like her closest friends now, you know, I don't know. It feels like a strange, I wish we had some more logic, different logic at this point about why she's wanting to move to Seattle. It just, that line just didn't really make sense to me.
Yeah, and like, It sort of depends, I guess, how strong you want the idea to move to Seattle to be, right? If she's not ultimately going to do it, you don't want, because I was going to say, like, oh, if she's like, oh yeah, I'm going to go to University of Washington next year anyway, so I'll just move to Seattle now, bond with my mom, like, whatever, fine. Or yeah, this like, oh, I've been, you know, haven't seen my mom much in the last like 2 years, I think they said. So going to go stay with her. Yeah, like, it was one of those things where they all went through this like really intense thing. But if anything, what Margot went through was like the least intense out of all of them. Like, Isaiah broke his arm. James was in a pit for like a week. Isabella got turned into a troll. And Lucas got like almost murdered by worms. Like, Margot got stuck into a book. And it was really not that big a deal. Like, everything else that she went through was the same as everything else. And I get that, you know, whatever, maybe that was tough for her. And she found out like her dad was cheating on her mom, I guess, like also part of it, but they seem over that. So that was all wild. And yeah, so I absolutely agree. Like, why would her getting through all of this be leaving and not, yeah, being here with like all the people who like understand what she went through, right? Yeah, it's stupid. And I agree with you that there were so many other like easy explanations they could have given where she's just like, I've always wanted to get out of Port Lawrence. This is a chance to bond with my mom, like anything. And then, you know, she can still come around to the idea next episode, which I sort of assume she will, of like, okay, I'll finish high school and then I'll move. Like, you can give that reason and it could be a legitimate one, but she can still decide to like wait a year maybe or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. I think we're just supposed to partially see this as like, we're going to get it in this episode of the like Seattle versus the Port Lawrence of it all, in the Margot versus Lucas of it all, right? That like he wants to like stay in this small town and run the harbor shop and never leave versus, which by the way is like a thing I will rant about when we get to it. And then Margot wants to like go to the big city and experience all this culture and all these things. Fine, but it, again, I agree with you, this like random line. It felt like there were so many lines this episode that were just not well thought out. Like, they were like, well, we need a reason for her to want to move here, so we're just going to write it and not think about if this fits the character that we have been writing for the last 8 episodes.
Yeah. I think the thing that you said about, you know, if it had been her saying that she always wanted to get out of Port Lawrence, I think that would have fit with everything we see in the rest of the episode with her at the party. And that would have like made a lot more sense. And even though we haven't necessarily seen a whole lot of her wanting to get out of Port Lawrence, I mean, we saw her like having no care about like the pep rally in the first episode, which is not necessarily mean that she wants to get out of there, but she is like, no, the nerdy girl, the well-read girl, maybe want to get out of the small town type thing. So I think that would fit, but they could have said it here and it would have made so much more sense than, yeah, I'm looking for a fresh start, but I don't want to lose my boyfriend. I'm like, I feel like a fresh start and losing your boyfriend is like, feels like a weird combo of things. Like I've always wanted to get away from Port Lawrence and here's my chance, but that makes more sense to me, but whatever.
It's just frustrating when we like riff off the spot like this in an hour long podcast and come up with better plot than the episode.
And I largely try to avoid doing that when I watch shows. I largely try to avoid doing the, but it would have been so much better if they did this. I try not to do that. Try to second guess. I try to just like accept the show for what it is. But this episode makes it really hard. So if anyone out there is like me and doesn't like people do that, my apologies. But that's what this episode is doing to my brain right now. So we see Nathan on his drive, listening to the writing podcast, which I thought this was kind of funny. Let the right one in. That's a nice horror reference pun, because it's W-R-I-T-E. But the podcast advises that every great story is born from darkness and has a twist. Which is not true, but whatever. At that moment, Nathan sees a road sign and realizes he's near where they drop Slappy, saying, that would be a real twist. He then ventures in the woods and finds Slappy's parts. So that's all it took. That's all it took for Nathan to decide to bring back the evil murderous doll, was someone saying, you need a twist.
Yeah. Did you see who the someone was who said they needed a twist, though? Did you see the name on the podcast?
No, I couldn't make it out.
It's R.L. Stein.
That was my guess. My guess is that was R.L. Stein, but on my screen, I could not make it out who it was.
Yeah, I think it was another one of those. I was like holding the laptop up to my face to be like, what is that? Yeah. But yeah, I did think that was a pretty funny little cameo. Because again, like, you can have funny horror, like, oh, hey, people that know things about this genre, which, like, at this point, you just need to know that R.L. Stein wrote the Goosebumps book. Like, that one's not a hard one to get. But it's like, hey, it's a little Easter egg for those who find it. Doesn't have to be. Like, we could have done more of that and not the weird. Anyway, I thought this was funny. This was good. Good job, show. Do more of this.
Yeah, no, I thought this was a really, really fun sequence with the even though I completely disagree with the writing advice, I think, you know, it was intentional in this case. But yeah, so Nathan has gone and found Slappy just because of a podcast he listened to. And I think I would speak on behalf of many of my co-hosts on podcasts, like, you know, don't necessarily listen to us about advice on things. Some things, yeah, but, you know, trust but verify at the very least. You know,
my joke frequently is that I like shouted at Kevin about the Mighty Ducks often enough that he was like, do you want to record some of these thoughts you hold so strongly? And that's how I started podcasting, with post-show recaps. There is no other qualification that I had beyond that, so don't take my word for anything.
Well, we cut back to Seattle, and Lucas and Margo are in line for fancy donuts. And Lucas tells Margo that he finds Seattle depressing, that everything has to be a big thing. Everything has to be a thing, like these donuts. He says that when he runs the harbor shop one day, they will serve just perfectly serviceable donuts. And Margo laughs until she realizes that he's serious about his long-term career goal. So this is where you're going to rant.
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, I go to Seattle all the time. I have a group of Ultimate Frisbee friends that all live in Seattle who I was just there for Halloween weekend. I was at a Halloween Frisbee tournament with them. And so I am quite familiar with Seattle. It absolutely, long lines, same as Vancouver. I think same as like a lot of cities. It gets really, there's like the new hotness of a thing. And then suddenly the lines are like really long for that particular new brunch spot or for a while. I definitely remember talking to a friend about this, about Toronto, where it felt like it went through waves, where it was like suddenly there were like a whole bunch of like donut or ice cream sandwiches was like a thing for a while. There was like a whole bunch of ice cream sandwich places that popped up, or there was a whole bunch of like fried chicken places that popped, and it'll like go through waves. So sure, I can see that like in this show, Seattle's going through a donut wave, and yeah, they're going to be all like weird and fancy. I will say the funny thing about the donuts, though, is that like the classic example of this is like Voodoo Donuts, which is not in Seattle. It's in Portland. There's like a few of them, but that's what that made me think of. So it's like Seattle's take on trying to do Voodoo Donuts. But the bigger rant I have about this conversation, Seattle is like smack dab in the middle of the Washington coast. Like it is a 3-hour drive south of me, and I can get to Oregon in 6 to 7. So it is like basically in the middle. And Port Lawrence is going to be a port town on the water, on the coast. So we're not even talking about like, you know, east to west time differences here, basically at all. Both are cities on the coast, which means at the absolute most, this is a 3-hour drive. At absolute, like the amount, I get it. They're in high school. Distance of any kind probably feels like the most unsurmountable thing ever. But first of all, they are literally going on a road trip to Seattle right now. Like that is doable. Second of all, like you, again, this is like, you could get there, take off from work early. You could get there in time for dinner. Like it is not that far away. Seattle traffic is really bad. But I still posit that you could make it work, and that this like ridiculous, like so far away, I never want to leave Port Lawrence. We will absolutely never see each other again, ever kind of thing, is ridiculous to me. So yeah, I just had to put that up. That was my rant where I was like, wait a second, how far away does he think Seattle is? Because I bet you it's like an hour. Unless he is on like the tippy tippy top or the tippy, which to be fair, considering they're technically filming in Vancouver, maybe it's 3 hours away. Like maybe Port Lawrence is just south of the border, but yeah, that was a part that I was like, what is happening here? This child has no concept of geography.
Yeah. Well, it's Lucas. So, what do you expect? The thing that really jumps out at me in here though, is like, He wants to stay in the small town. He wants to stay where he, you know, he feels comfortable and take over the harbor shop. And Margo laughs at him and then realizes, oh no. But I mean, if anything is sounding a death knell for the relationship, it's the fact that he like earnestly tells her what he wants to do. And her reaction is to laugh. Yep. Which again goes back to the like the opening thing of them, like him obviously trying to like, you know, appease her with her idea of what things should be. But, you know, Margo is someone who has ambitions to get out and do other things in the world, whereas Lucas is someone who is content to stay in his hometown and take over his mother's shop. And, you know, that's what he wants to do. He doesn't want to venture out into the big city, which as someone who is raised in a small town myself, like I understand that feeling to a certain degree. I wanted to get out of my particular small town just to get away from like everyone that I'd known my entire life and maybe reinvent myself a little bit. But even so, I've never have wanted to live in a big city. The living in a big city is just like something that has zero appeal to me. So I understand that to a certain degree, but it's just like, it's just not a great look whenever he like is very earnest about, you know, what he wants to do. And Margo just laughs in his face. It's like, ooh, yeah, that hurts. That hurts right there.
Yeah. I guess my part of my thing is that I again struggle with this idea that like Port Lawrence is being advertised as this like tiny, tiny town. that like no one ever leaves because all these people who went to high school there are still there or whatever. But it's in my mind, like if you grew up this close to, I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's all stupid. I feel bad for Lucas that Margot laughed at him. I think that is like not like clearly, you know, I think doomed for their relationship and a very like kind of understandable issue for high schoolers to have of like, hey, we like each other, but it turns out we have like completely different life goals and our lifestyles are not going to be compatible. So I think that that's totally fine. And I actually like didn't have a problem with that being an issue that was raised. I think, yeah, I don't know. It was just very funny to me. Maybe it just needed to be like literally anywhere else that I couldn't like literally map out. Like I've done this drive so many times. I know how far it is. It's not that far. So it just needed to be anywhere else. I'm just too familiar with the source material of it, I guess.
Well, I'll just say as someone who grew up just like an hour and a half, 2 hours away from a bigger city, it felt like forever to be able to, like, if we were going to Tulsa, and Tulsa's not even like a huge city, but still, if you know, much bigger than the town I grew up in, it felt like a big deal to drive to Tulsa whenever I was in high school. Like, after I went to college and everything, not so much, but at that age, it definitely was like, oh, wow, you know, having to go drive like a few hours to get somewhere. Depending on, I guess, where you grow up in relation to the place, it can like be a little bit more daunting. So that part didn't really like faze me at all.
Yeah, I grew up an hour outside of Vancouver, and it was funny when I first moved to Vancouver for grad school, people being like, oh, where should we go? Like, recommend us places. And I was like, the Italian that started grad school 4 months before I did actually knows more about Vancouver than I do because I came in here so rarely growing up. So that is fair. Although, yeah, still more often than I think it feels like Lucas has ever been to Seattle.
Yeah. Well, back home with the slappy parts, Nathan reads the magic words and Slappy revives, his parts crawling together and reassembling. Slappy tells Nathan he's going to give him the biggest ending of all time, and the stuffed Fifi suddenly comes back to life. Yeah. Well, this is like, that is a thing that happened. The doll parts moved on their own and there's an undead dog.
Yeah, you can tell I hated it. But mostly I don't like the doll coming back together. That was terrifying. And then, yeah, just this like eternal question of like, can Slappy do literally anything he wants? I'm very confused how the dog got brought back, but fine. Slappy has, you know, what needs to happen here, magic. And that's what he can do.
Yeah,
plot armor magic. There's got to be a way to say this.
It feels very much plot armor magic. I agree. It's very much a wizard did it type defense. Like, how did this happen? A wizard did it. Anytime you don't understand what happens in the show, a wizard did it. The classic Simpsons
or the classic D&D old magic. we just refer to something as old magic if it doesn't follow the rules of like any of what we know magic to be.
Exactly. Well, we then see the gang at a party, which they are apparently invited to by Margot's cousin. While there, Margot and James are impressed by the sophistication on display. And my favorite thing here is Margot going, they do art! There's like someone talking about doing their art, and Margot's just like so impressed that someone actually does art. Because obviously no one in Port Lawrence does any sort of art at all.
I actually thought this was very cute. I especially because I was like, these two absolutely would like go to Seattle and be like, I absolutely like know these people who have moved to Vancouver and made like the city their entire personality of like, I'm the city, you know, I'm here doing all the like funky things. And I can like remember that phase of high school of being like, oh, I just want to be like, I just want to meet other people who do cool things outside of my stupid small town. Like that felt very understandable. And then the fact that it was like James was getting in on that too, I was like, oh yeah, James would like absolutely be about whatever is going on with Seattle because it would just be so much cooler than whatever's going on in Port Lawrence.
Yeah. But like, because Mars like, they do art. And James is like, move here immediately. Yeah. James is all in on Margot going to experience the art. But I just love that. Just her little giddy, like almost like, you know, oh, they do art. And she's just like so excited about it. But of course, Lucas feels out of place at the party. Lucas and Margo get in a fight over her wanting to leave, and they break up. Which again was pretty much saw it coming. So not a surprise at all.
Yeah. In my notes, I say again, Port Lawrence and Seattle are probably an hour apart.
Yeah.
I was really hung up on this when I watched it.
Apparently. We then see Nathan following the resurrected Fifi into the woods, and she leads him to a spot where he starts to dig after she goes full devil dog to encourage him. Her whole face changes, eyes glow. Was not expecting that. I enjoyed it, but was not expecting the Fifi devil dog moment.
Yeah, I wrote, oh shit, scary Fifi is scary. This is the deep thoughts going on as I watch this episode.
Yeah, this is the analysis you come here for, folks. So we see Margo returns to her mom's place to find a note from Lucas saying he's already headed home. We see him getting on a bus back to Port Lawrence.
Yeah, I took that bus a week ago.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Once again, you recognizing all sorts of locations on the pod. Although this time,
I took a bus home from Seattle to Vancouver. Yeah. I'm assuming it's basically the same bus.
We then cut to Nathan, who's dug up the coffin that Ephraim had found for Slappy years earlier. And like Ephraim, he begins to read the magic words. And like Ephraim, he has a vision of a burning structure. However, unlike Ephraim, he lets Slappy push him into finishing the spell, which causes Slappy's spirit to leave the dummy and revive the body in the coffin. Ben arrives to talk to Nathan about the book, and the human Slappy turns him into a puppet. And then human Slappy strides off into the night with undead Fifi trailing at his heels. And that's the end of our episode.
Yeah. So, okay. So we get this like fiery tower thing again, which I don't know if you have any theories or if that you can speak to, if they're not like related to the next book or anything, but we get that. I'm assuming the other thing was like, every puppet that we've seen so far is like Harold's parents are dead, right? So are we to assume that Ben is now dead too? Like that seems shitty.
So, yeah. This has been a conversation in the Discord, the PSR Discord, have a conversation about this, about were Harold's parents killed because he turned them into puppets, or did he have them in the house and they burned up in the fire and that's how they died? Or did he do something else to them after they got like turned into puppets that wound up killing them? The show isn't super clear about that, but my sense, because the show hasn't been really clear, is like all that we saw Harold turn them into puppets, and then we see their ghost saying we're dead. And the kids also talked about how Harold killed his parents just from hearing him turning them into puppets during the story. So everything that we've heard so far points to the spell to turn people into puppets isn't just a temporary thing. It actually kills them. Now, maybe that's not the case. Maybe there is something else that could be done and something else killed his parents and it wasn't just being turned into puppets. We don't know for sure one way or the other. But I would say the text of the show so far is leaning towards being turned into puppet, kill someone. So in which case, yeah, Ben could be dead right now, which is kind of wild. Was not expecting that, but there is always a possibility that no, there's something else that could bring him back to life. It is Goosebumps after all, so it would not surprise me if we find out, oh, there actually is a way to save someone from being a puppet. But
That would make sense to me if it's like, yeah, because they were puppets, they could not escape the fire that happened. So like, yes, Harold did kind of kill them. But, you know, maybe the puppetry itself is not necessarily the means of death. So, yeah, that's sort of my assumption going into this, is that Ben isn't actually dead. But it did catch me by surprise. I wasn't expecting Ben puppet at all in this episode. And then, yeah, I don't know if you have any other thoughts on this tower, who this guy is, like what's going on. I'm very confused, but intrigued, I guess. We'll find out.
Yeah, so the tower, I have kind of two theories about what the tower represents. So the tower is being conjured in someone's mind as they're reading the spell to basically move Slappy's soul from the puppet into this human body. So you would assume that the burning tower is somehow attached to this spell. My main theory right now is that Slappy is this body. I mean, it's the only sense it makes to me that, you know, that's why he's like so intent on finding this body, is to get his soul back in his body. My assumption is that this is a magician, wizard, sorcerer, whatever a terminology they're going to use on the show. Some magic user of some kind who cast a spell to save himself and to place his soul in Slappy. And that casting that spell required a sacrifice. And that sacrifice was like burning this building down with people trapped inside. That's kind of what I'm guessing. So as they read the spell, they're seeing what the cost of the spell was originally. And that's what's going on. That's like the main theory that I have about what that vision is. It's the thing that makes the most sense to me. Now, originally, whenever Ephraim was reading the spell, my guess was that it was saying something in the future, something that was going to happen. Like, casting the spell is going to have this happen. But we've seen the result of the spell now, so I don't think the future vision makes as much sense. But that was my other thought heading into this episode, was that it had something to do, because next episode is called Welcome to Horrorland. Horrorland in the book series is a horror-themed amusement park run by monsters. My thought was maybe like this wooden structure was like some sort of ride or something at an amusement park, and that was like the spell was going to be involved, like something like that. But again, I was tying it to like people being sacrificed to do whatever Slappy was wanting to do. So that's kind of where my head is at. And I will say, so in the books that I've read, Slappy is, there's no indication of what Slappy's origins are. And actually, in the mythos of Goosebumps, there are multiple origin stories for Slappy explaining how he came to be. But one of those does involve him being an actual, like having a human soul that's like trapped inside the doll. But that's not always the origin. So which is the official origin of Slappy? Who knows? But it's possible that that's what they're going with. But that's kind of where my head is at after this episode.
Yeah, I'm definitely 100% with you in the, like, this is, like, the guy who's Slappy has been this whole time, and this is, like, him returning to his body. That totally makes sense to me. The only other idea that I had with the tower, if not a sacrifice, could be the, I like this idea of yours of, like, oh, putting the soul in the puppet to save him. And then was the magician killed in this tower, basically? Like, was that somehow we're viewing that, like, oh, it was some like Salem witch trial-esque thing that it was like, oh, well, I'm gonna like, we're trying to like get rid of this guy in particular, and he's going to his body is going to like burn up in this tower. Although I feel like we saw like multiple people, like multiple like screams.
Yeah. And because I do like the idea of like, that's actually where he died, and maybe people are trying to get him, and this is like a last ditch effort for him. But the multiple screams and the fact that Ephraim seeing this vision, he stopped, makes me wonder like what Ephraim was getting from all of this, like what his sense of the vision was. And it feels like it was more something that Slappy did than was done to him, but it could be both. I mean, why not both? It could have been them trying to get him and him making it worse as a way to save himself.
Yep.
I don't know.
We will find out, I guess. But yeah, it was interesting. It was like such a like went kind of episode, and then at the very end I was like, oh wait, what's going on here? And then I was like all intrigued again. And I was like,
yeah. It is wild that an episode called Night of the Living Dummy 2 that we get almost zero Slappy until the very end of it, and it's more of a taste of what's to come more than anything else. I feel like it would have made more sense to have, if we get more information, I guess in some ways, the revived Slappy is a living dummy. I guess the dummy is now living again. So maybe that's why they went with that title. But it feels just like, I feel like they could have named something else, because I think my expectations going to this were very different about what we were going to get this episode. And the fact that there was so little Slappy in an episode that was nominally Slappy-centric, probably didn't help my feelings towards, wait, we're supposed to be getting more slappy stuff, and all we get is this Nathan crap and this Lucas like relationship crap. I want more. I want slappy backstory at this point. I want to know what's going on. But I'm hoping that we'll get all of that in the next episode, because it's the last episode, so we got to have exposition, get that Stephen King ending.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if anything, I feel like this episode should have been called Give Yourself Goosebumps, because he's like writing essentially the Goosebumps book. But whatever, that's fine. Yeah, there we go. So we've got one episode left, and we will see how this series ends. I feel like on the whole, we have been so much higher on this series than we were on this particular episode. So I'm really hoping that this last episode doesn't end on like a want note and like undercut how good I think this season of television has been.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. It almost feels like, and I haven't looked into any history of the show or how it's done, it almost feels like they wrote an 8-episode series and left it on a cliffhanger, and then the publisher said, hey, you need to expand the ending because we need a little bit more of the backstory of Slappy. So, and if you don't get to us really soon, we're going to have to let you go. I feel like maybe everything with the publisher was maybe like a self-insert, like the writers of the show, because it almost feels like everything in this is like feels so tacked on and so slapdash and just so rushed. It almost feels like, yeah, they had a completed story and then we're told they had to do 2 more episodes and had to churn them out without any time to proofread. They just finished writing it and sent it off without editing. The writer of this episode was Nathan. That's it. That's all. That's my new theory, is that Nathan wrote this episode and had no time to edit it because the producers wanted it immediately. That is my story and I'm sticking to it. But
yeah, I honestly, I would not be surprised. I'm like frantically searching this Wikipedia page to see if it was, the only thing on here is it says that it was given a 10 episode order. But yeah, maybe it was a situation where they're like, yeah, we have this like tight little 8-episode series. And they were like, nope, do 10.
Yeah. It's honestly the only thing that makes this episode make sense to me, is that they had a story and then had to draw out. And I think have seen over the history of streaming services that the episode minimums, if you just look at most of the Marvel Netflix TV shows, those episode minimums really, really hurt a lot of the Netflix Marvel shows by making them drag out storylines longer than they need to be. So that makes a sort of sense to me about what happened here. Again, this is just guesswork. We have no idea if that's really what happened, but it makes a little bit of sense, especially like everyone I know who watched episode 8 was like, wait, there are 2 more episodes. Yeah. Brenna in the Discord was like, wait, what? You guys can talk about there being more episodes. How is there more episodes? I'm like, yeah, because it felt like such an ending. So I don't know. But hopefully...
And would have been one that wanted us to come back for season 2. That's the thing that gets me, is it was like, it was a good ending. Like things were pretty resolved, but also we had questions remaining. And like, I would have made a point of watching season 2 if that had been the ending. I don't know if I will, based on whatever ending we're going to get next week. So yeah, it's wild.
Yeah. So we'll see if we get how much resolution we get to all of this. We see if we get to find out what Slappy's master plan is. We'll see if we get any more history of him. We'll see if it ends on a cliffhanger of some sort, or if everything gets wrapped up in a nice, neat little bow. I'm hoping that they're able to stick the landing and that this one episode was a big aberration. I'm just hoping that this was just like a blip on the on the radar of everything, and that the episode 10 will come back strong.
Yeah, absolutely. So was there a Night of the Living Dummy 2 book in particular?
Yes. The first 3 books in this little series within Goosebumps were Night of the Living Dummy, Night of the Living Dummy 2, and Night of the Living Dummy 3. And then they got a little bit more creative with the titles after that. But I've only read the first 2. And the second one is very similar to the first one. You have a young girl who finds a ventriloquist dummy, reads the magic phrase, it comes to life, wants her to be its slave. Only this time it is actually Slappy as the evil dummy instead of a different dummy as the evil dummy throughout the book. And it's just like, you know, Slappy doing all these things to kind of like blackmail her into being his slave. The one notable thing is when she's like doing her act on stage and Slappy starts saying really horrible things, he then like vomits green goo onto the audience just out of nowhere. And that becomes a thing where he like vomits like disgusting green goo on people. The other thing I really want to mention about the Not Living Dummy books, which I meant to mention last time, that kind of like threw me for a loop, because, you know, I'm only like tangentially familiar with Slappy and largely from like the Goosebumps movie and just seeing like pictures of him, whatever. But throughout most of this show, Slappy doesn't really move on his own. He just sits there outside of his parts crawling together. You don't really see Slappy getting up and walking around and running around, moving around, doing anything on his own. If he doesn't have someone else carrying him, he can't really do anything. That's not the case in the books. Slappy comes alive. Slappy runs around, does all sorts of stuff. Like in the second book, he keeps breaking into the girl's sister's room and drawing graffiti on her wall and blaming it on her and things like that. But also, Slappy beats the crap out of these little kids. Like the girls like try to tackle Slappy, and Slappy's biting and punching them in the gut and kicking them and like... I was not expecting Slappy to be so like physically violent whenever I was reading the Night of the Living Dummy books. It's just like threw me for a loop when it says, and then Slappy punched her in the gut. I'm like, what? It just is like not even remotely what I was expecting to happen in those. But yeah, that's kind of like the general idea of the Night of the Living. The first few Night of the Living Dummy books seem to like follow the same pattern of Slappy just wanting a slave. And apparently like the magic powers of Slappy don't start happening until after Night of the Living Dummy 3. It's like the later books where suddenly Slappy starts developing and demonstrating all sorts of wacky magic abilities as the story needs. It's not necessarily consistent what he can and can't do. Apparently, the ability to turn people into puppets came about because of a spell he learned in the Horrorland series. It's apparently a plot point in the Horrorland series. So that's a nice segue into next episode, Welcome to Horrorland.
Yeah, so we've sort of talked about our predictions a little bit about what we think like the explanation for the end of this scene is. And I guess it's basically going to be, I don't know, my guess is that this guy who's probably been dead a very long time is going to be all like weirded out by modern time. I think that they'll try to play that for laughs maybe. And he'll try to be like walking down the street and people will be like, who's this guy? But then like, they are going to have to, I don't know how much power he has in terms of like how much his magic is, but that somehow the kids are going to have to like band together and stop him. Other general predictions. I don't think I don't know if like, okay, I'm going to say that the show is going to, Isaiah and Isabella are going to end up together and Margot and Lucas are not. That is my like somewhat bold prediction for a YA show. Yeah, I don't know. Do you have any other predictions that you can make considering I know you've sort of read this book, but not really, I assume?
Yeah, sort of not really. I've read a Horrorland book, but not this one because Welcome to Horrorland is just kind of like a book of like facts about creatures from the series. So it's not an actual novel. It's just like a collection of facts and stuff like that. First of all, I'm going to co-sign your relationship predictions. I think that makes a lot of sense, especially the Margot Lucas of it all. The Isabel Isaiah, I agree that that's probably what they're going to do, but it also wouldn't surprise me if it's more Isabella, like finally admits how she's feeling and they don't quite resolve it. I guess it all depends on how much of a bow they're going to put on everything in this, but I definitely think there will be movement on the Isaiah Isabella front. I just don't know if they're going to get full relationship or not, but considering how quickly the Isabella crush like advanced, it wouldn't surprise me if they went to like full boyfriend girlfriend, because that's the end of the show. Seems to do relationship on the, it's like 0 to 100, you know, in like a second. The Horrorland of all, I'm really curious about why they chose that as a title. Because again, Horrorland in the books is like an amusement park run by monsters. Mm-hmm. So that's like nothing to do with anything that we've seen here. But I do wonder if the Horrorland is actually going to be, is like Slappy going to try to like build his own world here? Is he like, he's like going to start transforming Port Lawrence into his vision of what the world should be? Is that what he's going to be doing with his magic? Or is he going to build this amusement park as a way to start drawing people in to do nefarious things to them? I mean, I think that would be, I would like that. I would like that if what happens is Slappy builds that. And then like the next season is them trying to like stop this amusement park and free people who've been like, if like we had like a cursed amusement park season, I would be all in for like the next season. If this is like setting up that, like this episode is him trying to build this and the kids trying to stop him and then them failing and having to try to convince people about what's going on next season or getting trapped in Horrorland and not able to get out and having to deal with all that. That would be something that I would be all in for. But also it could just be much like You Can't Scare Me. It could just be like, oh yeah, we need one more title. Let's grab this. And Horrorland is just like more of a metaphor than anything else. My main thing is I just want to get a little bit more about what Slappy's big plan is. Like, what is he wanting to do? What is his ultimate goal? And hopefully we find out a little bit more about him. I would love it if the episode opened up with like a flashback, like the opening sequence. We get another flashback, which is opened up with quite a few times. We get a flashback to human Slappy before he became dummy Slappy and what he was doing that led to his demise. I would love it if the episode opened up with that to set the stage for whatever was coming next. And we didn't have to like wait all episode to get the full exposition.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we get the Slappy backstory that the publicist wanted, right? Probably at the start of the episode. That makes sense.
Yeah. Fingers crossed, which again, like in retrospect feels like some sort of commentary on what they're doing, but I just don't know. But we'll see if we get a Stephen King of an ending or a good ending. That's going to be our, I think, how we're going to judge next episode. Stephen King ending or not. And that kind of brings us to the horror recommendations. Because I had a couple of things I was thinking about. I'm like, well, I could do like Stephen King recommendations since that's been so much of what got talked about here. Or I could do like things about writer, like, you know, horror tales that have writers as a protagonist, but I could just combine them, because if you throw a dart at a stack of Stephen King media, like you're have a really good chance of hitting one where a writer is the protagonist. The Shining, Salem's Lot, 1408, Secret Window, The Dark Half, Misery, Bag of Bones, Stand By Me, not a horror one, but a Stephen King thing one where the narrator is like a writer and all that. And there are some, those are just the ones I can seriously just name off the top of my head those. And there are quite a few more. It's like one of the things that he's known for is kind of going to the, hey, my protagonist is a writer. Well, quite often. So out of those, I mean, I've already recommended The Shining before. I've already recommended Misery before. I would recommend Bag of Bones. I really enjoyed Bag of Bones. There was a miniseries made out of it, which whatever, but the book I thought was really, really good. And I would also recommend, before you read Bag of Bones, read Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, because it has very, very strong ties to Rebecca. Because the main character is a writer, and he like makes all these connections between like the situation in with the things that happen in Rebecca. But Bag of Bones, I really enjoyed that quite a bit. So out of like the Stephen King writerly novels that or media, because 1408 was a short story that made into a movie. Secret Window was a novella that made into a movie, which is pretty good, but it also has Johnny Depp in it. So depending on your Johnny Depp tolerance these days, you might, you know, take it or leave it. But another thing that I was going to recommend is a book called Kill Creek by Scott Thomas. And I will preface this by saying this book has some things that some people have found problematic. So take that into consideration. Things that I didn't necessarily pick up on the stuff, and I don't know, but there are definitely people who felt that some of the concerns about how well the author writes female characters is the main thing, which I co-sign that it was not necessarily a great depiction of the main female character, but at the same time, I don't know, I felt like that's what he was going for, making this like a not likable character, but never, she's the only woman in the book largely. it's a tainted a bit, but I felt like I need to bring it up because one of the premise is there are these four horror writers of various kind of types of genres, you know, and they all get invited to this haunted house, and the force in there basically is trying to get them to write its story and promising them like kind of like riches and fame if they'll write its story, which I felt was like very on brand with the slappy Nathan of all this time. Also, one of the four authors is a man who's not really respected by the other writers because he writes juvenile horror and has written countless juvenile horror books. And it's very much feels like a thinly veiled R.L. Stein stand-in. It's not a one-to-one thing, but the fact that whenever I was reading the book, my main thought was, oh, this is R.L. Stein, even though... Most of the things about the character doesn't really match up with R.L. Stein, but it's like, it's that sort of, you know, type of author. So that was something that I felt like I should bring up Kill Creek, but also keep in mind that it has some things that might be a little problematic.
Gotcha. Cool. Thanks for all of that. And Todd, what do you got to plug? What else are you up to right now?
So right now, as usual, find me at Librarian Todd, because Todd Librarian is too many characters on most social media. You can find me over on One Indescribable Podcast, where Adam, TV Lindy, and I are going through Girls 5 Eva, getting pretty close to the end of season one, because it's pretty short seasons. And I believe by the time that this drops, you'll also have a podcast from Adam and myself here on Posture Recaps, talking about the new Apple Plus TV series, Monarch, Legacy of Monsters. The show drops on November 17th, but Adam and I just recorded a preview pod to talk about Monarch. If you're not familiar with it is the show based on the Monsterverse movies, aka Godzilla and King Kong movies from the last several years. So Adam and I both watched the four Monsterverse movies over the last week. And so we talked about those, where the show fits into the chronology of all that, just some of the things to know about the show. So that should be dropping soon.
I can't imagine that Adam is having the best of times watching four monster movies.
It did take him. I watched the four movies basically in a day and a half. Adam watched them over the course of a week, and like breaking them up into like 40-minute chunks so he can make it through. But I will say that he seemed to enjoy them more than I was expecting him to. So
great, that's awesome. So yeah, if you are not done hearing Todd's expert knowledge about genres he knows very well, highly recommend checking it out. Otherwise, you can find me over on Twitter, MelissaW28, MelissaWoodward28 on other social media. I am talking Doctor Who. I'm talking Dimension 20. I am talking Lessons in Chemistry. That is it for the foreseeable future, but that's a lot of places. So yeah, check those things out. And then we will be back with the final episode of Goosebumps next week. So send us in if you have any feedback for the series at large. If you have any questions, let us know. We would love to hear it and share it on the pod. Find us in the Discord, find us on Twitter, and we will catch you next time. Bye.